the baby, river's rising. Old frame house, she can't take one more beating.
This is part three of Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916, a four-part audio documentary based on the film by David Weintraub. I'm Kim Clark. During the first two installments of this series, we heard some harrowing stories handed down through the families of the survivors of the flood of 1916 who were living along the Eastern Continental Divide, where up to 20 inches or more of rain fell on Saturday, July 15, 1916. And that was after soaking rains had already been falling for over a week. The destruction, primarily caused by mudslides in those high elevations, was staggering. On the morning of Sunday, July 16th, the unprecedented amount of runoff from the rains was making its way downstream, causing catastrophic flooding. The blowing of the cotton mill whistle and the ringing of the fire bell early that morning awoke the residents of Asheville, where the rain in the city the day before had brought only inconvenience and annoyance. Word quickly spread, though, about the disaster that was unfolding in Biltmore Village, where the Swannanoa and the French Broad Rivers converge. There, people were stranded on the upper floors of hotels and factories and were clinging to lumber piles and trees as the river quickly grew to over a mile wide. A frantic warning went out to the communities farther downstream. As a result, most people on down were able to get out of harm's way, although their homes and businesses were lost. In Marshall, only the courthouse was left standing, and 53 homes were washed away. In Biltmore Village, hundreds of onlookers watched as Captain Lipe, head carpenter of the Biltmore estate, and four girls clung to a tree near the Lipe home in neck-deep water. Numerous rescue attempts were unsuccessful, and over the long hours, one by one, the group became exhausted and slipped into the swirling waters, to the horror of those who were helplessly watching. Only Captain Lipe's youngest daughter survived, after a young man was able to swim out to her with a rope and to tie her securely to the tree. Other men had sped to Skyland to get a flat-bottomed boat, and they used it to finally get the girl to high ground at about 2 in the afternoon. In those days of primitive or non-existent fire departments and no rescue squads, everyone was a first responder, a responsibility that was accepted without question. Dozens of men and boys swam rope out to people trapped on rooftops and in trees. Carpenters from the Biltmore estate built a boat, and it was used to rescue numerous families who were stranded near the depot. When one exhausted rescuer washed downstream until he achieved a precarious hold on a clump of bushes, a nearby innkeeper tied together a string of sheets and repeatedly tossed them out to him until the man was able to grab hold and be pulled to safety. Mrs. Vanderbilt of the Biltmore estate met each rescuer with hot coffee or whiskey as he emerged from the water and arranged for transport to the hospital for all who required it. An unknown man swam out to the Biltmore livery stable and cut the horses loose so they could swim for their lives. Three men who had jumped from the top of a house that was being carried through Biltmore Village by the churning river were pulled from the water by onlookers. Two boys tragically drowned while trying to take food to guests marooned in the upper stories of Glen Rock Hotel. Across the region, as residents began to grasp the full scope of what had happened, their first thoughts were to help those in need. Laverne Haydock's family was living in the Batcave area.
The next day, people were out trying to see if they could help other people. People were, of course, stranded across creeks because the creeks that had run near their houses had taken the houses, and they were up on the hill on the other side. And they would string wire across the river and use a flat-bottom boat and pull across to get them and bring them back.
Donald Freeman's family lived on Cox Creek near Edneyville.
My grandparents, they lost everything. Their crops were destroyed. They had lost one of their draft animals, the mule. They lost their hog that it would have killed in the following year. So only the things that they had was perhaps what my grandmother had been able to can up until July the 16th of 1916. So it was a very troubling time for them. They had to really pull together. Of course, in those days, people would help each other, and they were able to stay with some family members for about 3 weeks until the community was able to help them get their house restored so they could live in it and get the barn rebuilt. People would come together as a group. They would go out and they would actually have barn raising, house raisings. And the church was very instrumental. They was a very faith-backed group of people that believed in helping other people and helping them be able to get their house restored.
The churches were the main relief efforts. It was churches such as Silver Creek Baptist Church down in Polk County that opened their doors for the victims and people and families that were fleeing the floodwaters down on Brights Creek and in Green River Cove. And sometimes those families had to live in those churches for several days before those floodwaters went down, or until they could find a family member that wasn't flooded out that could take them in and house them until they could rebuild. But the churches didn't just help in the immediate aftermath by supplying food and housing and clothing. They also helped through that winter, so that was the center point for going to get food to keep your family alive and eating through that next winter. Of course, the worst thing about the flood of 1916 was the loss of life and those people that died. But what people sometimes forget is that this flooding hit in July. You've already planted your crops, they're already growing. You're not going to have time to plant any more crops. So your harvest is destroyed. You have no fall harvest. The majority of the people were self-sustaining farmers. How are they going to get through the winter? They have no crops to bring in the fall, to keep through the winter, to can and so forth, to keep the family alive through the winter, because you didn't have the food to harvest to get through the winter.
That's Henderson County historian Jenny Jones-Giles, whose family, like many in the area, discovered that the Great Flood had not only destroyed their harvest, it had destroyed their ability to farm in the future.
What they discovered within a few months, or by the next spring when they started to plant, was that all their topsoil had washed away. They could no longer farm. And these were Appalachian Mountain self-sustaining farmers. And without farming, they had no way of making a living. Well, then they couldn't sell the property because nobody wanted to buy it because it was not suitable for farming. And the only thing my great-grandfather could do would be to sell the timber rights to the property to give them enough money to move out. And they ended up coming into Henderson County and working as sharecroppers.
Laverne Haydock's grandfather expressed his worries in a letter written shortly after the flood.
My grandfather talked in his letter about that all the soil had washed away and everything that was to eat had washed away. And that the hardest job they had was finding food, that there was no place to plant anything because all the soil was gone and he didn't know what they were going to be able to do.
The railroad was a necessity because relief supplies couldn't be brought in until the trains were running.
Their lives depended on the railroad getting back in place again. And so everybody worked on repairing the railroad. Didn't matter if they worked for the railroad then, but everybody who could handle the equipment was out working on clearing up the railroad.
Bill Carson of the Orchard at Alta Pass, which was on the Clinchfield line. The southern railway line through the mountains had been decimated. Every bridge between Marion and Asheville, except for one, was gone. Huge fills had been washed away. Miles of track were buried under huge mudslides, and the tunnels were full of debris. The longest undamaged section of track between Old Fort and Ridgecrest was measured at only 0.5 mile. Miraculously, regular train service between Asheville and Black Mountain was restored on July 24th. And operations resumed between Old Fort and Ridgecrest on August 27th, just 5 weeks after the second hurricane had moved through. This incredible accomplishment was achieved with only pick, shovel, steam shovel, derrick, and manual labor. The work went on around the clock, with the night shifts working by lantern light. Tune in tomorrow morning at this same time for the final installment of this special series commemorating the 100th anniversary of the flood of 1916, when we'll look at what we've learned from those events of a century ago. This program is a production of WNCW and the Center for Cultural Preservation in Hendersonville, North Carolina. It's based on the film Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916 by David Weintraub, which is currently touring the state of North Carolina and is also available on DVD, with more information at saveculture.org. The film was made possible in part by the support of Phillips and Karen Cutright, Bob and Barbara Chapin, and Adept Word Management. The theme music is Muddy Water by The Seldom Seen. Interviews for this program were conducted and recorded by David Weintraub. The film was adapted for radio by me. I'm Kim Clark. Join us tomorrow for part 4 of Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916.